Again, we want to just introduce ourselves briefly. We are Mavis and Phil Anderson. Mavis is with the Augsburg College Center for Global Education in Minneapolis, which conducts many travel seminars to the Central America region, tries to highlight the world realities and our connections to those. Most recently, I've been the Lutheran World Federation Department of World Service representative in Central America, primarily living in El Salvador, but traveling extensively throughout all of Central America. In light of today's topic on Nicaragua and democracy, what shapes democracy, and what sort of the outcomes of the elections there this past February, we want to engage again in conversation and dialogue with you. I was invited after I had to leave El Salvador in November last year because of the offensive there to head up an observer team, which was comprised of representatives of the World Council of Churches, the U.S. National Council of Churches, the Lutheran World Federation based in Geneva, and the Latin America Council of Churches. And so we had 25 people in Nicaragua from mid-December up until early March of this year, 1990, observing the electoral process. It's not simply a question of being there on election day to see the dynamics involved and what goes on in terms of voting and the outcomes of an election, but to see an entire process. And that was a great privilege and a great learning experience for all of us to have participated in that really wonderful experience of the electoral process in Nicaragua. So I will do a little more of the talking on this today. Mavis also has experience in Nicaragua, and we hope to all engage in this conversation. Just a couple of thoughts I want us to keep in mind as we talk today and engage in conversation before I go on to looking at some of the background history of Nicaragua. I want to ask a question of all of us: is what makes for democracy? How do we know it? What's the relationship of elections to democracy, if there is a connection? How do we ensure participation? We might even ask some questions of the United States' current democratic process in terms of our own participation here. And then, certainly, how is the United States beginning to use the edge of foreign policy promotion of U.S.-style democracy around the world? It will begin to be a major component of our foreign policy vis-a-vis Eastern Europe. And there is, within that, a new organization in the last two or three years formed by Congress, the National Endowment for Democracy, which has as its stated objective the teaching of sort of U.S.-style democratic process around the world. That was requested by President Ronald Reagan and had an influence in the Nicaraguan electoral process. The United States Congress funded the opposition party, the UNO, up, some say, 9 million, some say higher, to 16 million U.S. dollars to fund the opposition party of another country. Another question, obviously, I think that we need to look at in terms of Nicaragua over the last 10 years is the way in which we have conducted a foreign policy, we might say low-intensity conflict in that region and its outcome, the defeat of a government. And so how was low-intensity conflict used, what were its means, and what are its goals in that region? We also, if we get time, if there's interest, we could look at the challenges now facing the current government of Violeta Barrios de Chamorro and the UNO coalition, or alliance as it's called. It's a 14-party, very diverse coalition from very extreme left, you may say, Marxist-Leninist elements, to very conservative parties. So that's kind of what I want to get at in terms of a dialogue together this morning. Central Americans and Latin Americans always remember their own history much better than I think we do as North Americans. We forget history. It might be interesting to look at a bit of Nicaragua rapidly. 1821, Central America declares independence from Spain. And I think that even is an issue yet, whether or not Central America, Latin America, is independent. I mean, there may be a relative independence of all nations around the world, but I think in some ways what many countries in Latin America are still looking for is more independence, self-determination. But at least that came about 1821. 1823 was the Monroe Doctrine, where the United States basically said, Latin America is our sphere of influence, the Europeans out. You will note that by 1833, the United States actually occupies, invades Nicaragua for the first time. And so we have a long history, 160 years nearly, of U.S. presence in the Central America region, Nicaragua being one primary target of that intervention. There is the anomaly, in fact, of a U.S. citizen who goes to Nicaragua in the mid-1950s and declares himself a president. He was later assassinated in Honduras. It's interesting now, the ambassador of El Salvador's name is William Walker. It's sort of like 100 years later, and he is some heir, descendant of that William Walker. The interesting issue there is that Nicaragua, we can't see this map very well, I'm sure, from all angles, but has what could be an interesting sea route between the Atlantic, the Caribbean, and the Pacific, along what is the Rio San Juan in the south. It would be much easier to construct that in some ways than what it took to construct the Panama Canal. It's still under consideration to build a canal along this area. So the United States and other countries have tremendous interest in this isthmus in addition to just Panama. Another option is this small isthmus, Tehuantepec, in Mexico. So there are some geopolitical interests in the region. Interestingly, too, and it fits into the dynamic very much of Nicaragua, unlike, say, El Salvador, which does not have an Atlantic coast, is that fully half of Nicaragua, territorially, is very divided, very distinct from the Pacific coast, where the Spaniards settled and colonized. The Atlantic coast is very underpopulated, and it had much more of connections to what was going on in the Caribbean, where the British were the dominant colonial power, the buccaneers, the pirates, the black freed slaves, or those who escaped, settled throughout the Caribbean and settled along the Caribbean coast. And so here you have both an indigenous Indian population, the Miskito Indians, the Sumos, the Ramas, and also black people. And their primary language is English from that British colonial period. And it was not until 1894 that the Atlantic coast was more or less incorporated into what we have today as Nicaragua. That's an important feature because in this election now in 1990, the coastal areas, through the Constitution, set up their own autonomous government within the Republic of Nicaragua. And the Miskitos now have, in the north particularly, their own autonomy within their assembly. This was followed by a number of U.S. military inventions, highlighted by the establishment of a Nicaraguan National Guard, putting into power Anastasio Somoza García, and then his son, Luis, and later Luis's brother, again Anastasio Somoza García. So there's 40, 50 years of the Garcias in the National Guard. And this period was basically one of keeping the status quo, and Somoza operated the National Guard pretty much as his own private army, and pretty much all of the treasury was wrapped up in his own personal empire, to the extent that he personally owned one quarter of all of the arable land and another sizable portion of the land in Nicaragua was owned by cohorts of the Somozas. During this period, there was the individual of Augusto Cesar Sandino, who rose up in opposition to this foreign occupation. And in 1961, then there is the formation of the Frente Sandinista para la Liberación Nacional in honor of Cesar Augusto Sandino. And then there was a period of increased attacks against and trying to reduce the repression of the Somozas. 1972 is an important moment in Nicaraguan history. The earthquake in Managua, which hit on Christmas Eve there. See, we have, I can't remember your name.
Gene.
Gene has a brother, Jerry Aker, who is the representative for Lutheran World Relief now in Lima. Jerry had just come back from Peru, I understand, and was called by Lutheran World Relief to go immediately to Managua to assist in the earthquake recovery, along with Church World Service and a number of other agencies. It's an important era because it began to polarize sectors within the Nicaraguan society, including the Catholic Church from Somoza. That is where they really came to loggerheads. Previously, Cardinal Ovando y Bravo had been rather benign with relationship to Somoza. They were in some ways friends. But Somoza became very, very greedy, and there was a struggle between Cardinal Ovando and Somoza over the issue of how to go about assistance. And the Catholic Church wanted to use and channel humanitarian assistance for reconstruction. Somoza wanted it all for himself. He stole tremendous amounts of the money that was donated to Nicaragua at that time. So there was a big breach. That's an important factor because where the Catholic Church goes, also goes, in the case of Nicaragua, also goes eventually the way the government has gone. So then there was a period of increased military opposition of the FSLN in 1978. Assassination, very, very important, of Pedro Joaquín Chamorro, editor of La Prensa, which was and is or has been a very important opposition newspaper. And he and other people formed a group called the Group of 12, which was trying to find a transition way out. And Jimmy Carter was working with the Group of 12 to find a transition from the Somoza era. His assassination provoked alliance between the peasants and the workers and more of the middle class and the upper class against Somoza, get Somoza out. Who is Pedro Joaquín Chamorro today? He is the widow of now Violeta Barrios de Chamorro, president of Nicaragua. Violeta Barrios de Chamorro's claim to fame and her aura is that she is the widow of Pedro Joaquín Chamorro. She is not a political figure, has really no political experience, but it was found that to have her, it calls up this whole aura of opposition, huh? So you can get opposition to also the Sandinistas. It's interesting that the Chamorro name goes back way into the last century. And one of the presidents of in 1875 was Pedro Joaquín Chamorro. So it leads up to Triumph of the Revolution, July 19, 1979. Another major event that has an impact, I recall very vividly on me and maybe some of the others of you, the assassination of Bill Stewart, a U.S. Washington-based correspondent for ABC or NBC or something like that, who had been in Minneapolis, and that's how I remember him. But that, I think, also coalesced. It's interesting how the assassination of a U.S. citizen, and he was just brutally shot. He was put down on the ground, and his film or crew filmed this assassination from their car. And he was kicked, first of all, and then they just shot him in the head a few times. So we have the Triumph of the Revolution, as it is called and known within Nicaragua, at least within the Sandinista circle. It brings about then a period of tremendous reform. Certainly there's some initial struggles because it wasn't only the Sandinistas that were involved there, but they gained the upper hand. And then there were major important initiatives in literacy and healthcare, agrarian reform. And I at the time was working in Colombia as a missionary of the American Lutheran Church. And I could say that within Latin America there was a certain euphoria about this triumph of a revolution within Latin America and a lot of interest. So in 1980 I visited Nicaragua on my way up through all of Central America, and I was captivated also by the dynamic spirit of many, many people, young people particularly, in this new moment. And Nicaragua was beginning to know each other. I went up on some pickup trucks, in the back of pickup trucks, with young people going out to do literacy on the East Coast. And it was the first time the Pacific Coast people got to know Atlantic Coast people, and it was a new mix. But by November 1981, the United States effort was to continue to support in some way the ex-National Guard, the Contras. When we now use the word Contras, there are others who have been involved other than just ex-National Guard, but the origins were in the same people that were defeated. When I was in Nicaragua in 1980, you could hear rumors and accounts of ex-National Guard still out in the mountains around Matagalpa and other areas in the north, and some who had gone to Honduras. Actually, there was an intent to take some territory then, particularly on the Atlantic coast, and that's where the Nicaraguan government made a judgment to remove the Miskito Indians from some of the areas of the Atlantic coast. And as a result of that and some other things, they have never had a very good relationship with the Miskitos on the Atlantic coast, or not with all, because they burned some of the villages of the Miskitos. The accounts of assassinations of the Miskitos do not prove to be accurate, but to remove some 10,000 people forcibly from their homes. And for the Indian people in any culture, it's important, the land upon which they live. And those people live along the Rio Coco, and for them the Rio Coco is their home, their life. For them to live along the river is life. And so they were moved, their huge new community set up, Tazbukri, which the churches helped to fund through the Nicaraguan government.
Before you leave,
yes.
Why did the Nicaraguan government do that? I mean, you said that they did it and they made a mistake, but what was the reason?
Yeah, exactly. Because this Contra effort, which November 81, there was a period we call the Red December, when there was an alert, possible invasion of Nicaragua coming in through the Atlantic coast and probably across from Honduras, which is, it's quite remote, but it kind of served as a beachhead. There's a small town near Puerto Cabezas where a potential invasion could have come, just to establish some territory. And the Miskito Indians were being instrumentalized. During the Somoza era, they never had much relationship to the government of Nicaragua. And it was kind of a weak point that the Sandinistas, as I mentioned, had some difficulty in relating there. As the first thing that they did were to send some of their military people to the Atlantic coast to kind of say, here we are and we're going to run the show. Well, Somoza had never even done that so much. He was benign, total benign neglect of the Atlantic coast. Rather than sending in military people, would have been much, much better to establish some kind of other link. And the literacy program, for example, their initial efforts were to teach people in the Spanish language. Well, that's about their fourth language. Spanish, Miskito coming first, and perhaps their English, and maybe another Indian language, Creole, on that coast, and then English, or then Spanish. So the effort was to reduce the possibility of a population in that area. Some 10,000 or more Miskito Indians then fled into Honduras and became bases for recruitment of further Contras. Excuse me. We'll go some more quickly. So there is the beginning of the U.S. presence in Honduras. That's a major item, kind of the occupation of Honduras as a territory for U.S. military presence. I once was invited to go along on a trip to the Mosquitia to view, observe the United States actually coming in to bring food assistance to the Miskito refugees. And we went through the international airport of Tegucigalpa as if we owned it. As the United States, we got on C-140s and flew out to the Mosquitia and then helicopters around, as if it were our territory. And that's how we have managed Honduras very much over the last few years. Historic visit of Pope John Paul II to Managua primarily had to do with both an attack, certainly on the Nicaraguan government, but also on the church, the popular church. That's where he created kind of a schism there. Then in 84, the intensifying of the low-intensity conflict with the mining of the port of Corinto, and a rebuke by the International Court of Justice, which the United States has never acknowledged. 1984, Daniel Ortega was elected president with 67% of the vote, with six opposition parties. It's interesting there that probably the major opposition at that time was from a liberal independent party whose candidate was Virgilio Godoy. He is now the vice president with Violeta Barrios de Chamorro, but he pulled out shortly before the elections. Probably because the United States encouraged him to do so, thereby saying that the elections would not be credible. He wouldn't go to elections because that was a setup at any rate. From 1985 until the present, there's been a trade embargo. In 1986, we began to see the whole effects of the Iran-Contra affair. 1987, then there begins a peace process within the Central America, taken on by the presidents of Central America themselves. That's important because the country which has most followed step by step by step the Central America Peace Accords has been Nicaragua. Some countries like Guatemala and Honduras and Costa Rica have not implemented at all some of those measures that they have called for. By 1988, as a result of Esquipulas II and the Arias Peace Plan, the government of Nicaragua and the Contras called for a provisional ceasefire at Zapoala. A hurricane, very devastating in 1988, $800 million devastation. Mavis and I both were in Nicaragua shortly after and traveled out to the Atlantic coast. Tremendous devastation in that area with all the forests down. It's interesting being in this context, just wiped out all of the forests, which was a major enterprise for the Atlantic coast and for Nicaragua, and the fishing industry on the Atlantic coast. 89, February, Central America summit again in El Salvador. The elections in Nicaragua were pushed up from, supposedly they were going to be November of this year, pushed up to February. The idea being that if Nicaragua went through an electoral process, there would be the understanding that then the Contras would be demobilized. So the quicker we get to elections and the legitimacy of those elections, the Contras would be dismantled. So then there's the electoral process about which we can speak some more with the United Nations and the Organization of American States supervision. Actually, again, it's interesting. The UN and the Organization of American States were in Nicaragua as of August. So again, it's a long process, and there were a lot of subtle and not so subtle changes made along the way. How do you go about really conducting elections? For many people, this was the first time they had participated in elections, particularly on the Atlantic coast among the Miskitos. And there were time after time revisions as made to make the electoral process more participatory and more fair. At times they were not fair. I could cite, for example, the use of the media, particularly the television, which was in the hands of the state, that is, in the hands of the party of the FSLN. And initially, there was much, much more propaganda on the part of the FSLN. Though time was given each night, 1 hour, there was debate set up between two particular parties. So they did have airtime. But the FSLN had all day long with commercials or between commercials to do their thing. 25 February, Violeta Barrios de Chamorro was elected. And it was an astounding surprise. I think even the UNO, the Unión Nacional Opositora, was surprised at their victory. And as were most of us, including the Supreme Electoral Council and I'm sure Daniel Ortega and others. We followed the elections, of course, very intently, very closely. There was no victory celebration on the part of the UNO within the first few days. I think they were just stunned and not prepared to celebrate. The news came in late at night. Actually, I was observing a particular electoral counting process in one community from 6 o'clock. It went to midnight that night, and there in a poor barrio of Managua, a working class barrio, and they lost resoundingly there. And that was kind of an indication to me, well, things could be different than everybody assumed. And then by 3 in the morning, the statistics were beginning to come out through computers. Tremendous apparatus had been set up to get the electoral count in, and then this defeat. And by early morning, of Monday by 7 o'clock, Daniel Ortega acknowledged his defeat and very graciously then went to see Violeta Barrio de Chamorro that afternoon. Together with one of his major supporters, Carlos Fernando Chamorro, editor of the Barricada, the newspaper of the Frente Sandinista, and son of Violeta Barrios de Chamorro. So we have the taking of power on the 25th of April. Now we're in a period, a very interesting moment. We're coming to the finalization of this process, the demobilization of the Contras. The target date had been set last August, that by the 5th of December, the United Nations would observe the total demobilization of the Contras. That date has been successively moved back and moved back and moved back. Should have been done then before the elections, then done before the taking of power of the elected Barrios, then done by 10th of June, and now just more recently, another 20 days was given. So by the 30th of June, the demobilization should have taken place. Again, many of these things are step by step, and it takes time. I'm sure that many of the Contras also didn't expect this takeover. When I was in Nicaragua during the electoral process, I was down way in the south toward the Costa Rican border, and of tremendous Contra activity and support of people, and they were clear that they would never put down their weapons under the presidency of Daniel Ortega and the Frente Sandinista. So let's see where we are, if this stirs up some conversation or some questions that you may have, please.
Was this a better move towards land reform? The way the election went?
Toward land reform, that's interesting. That will be a struggle, definitely, because there has been a very successful land reform within Nicaragua, not as radical a land reform on paper as that of El Salvador, which basically expropriated lands from many, many landowners in 1980. In the case of Nicaragua, basically what happened was that the land of Somoza was taken over. And that has been used either as state land or turned into privately owned cooperatives by people. And the one issue will be, will some of that land revert to prior landowners? There will be a struggle. That will be one of the challenges faced by this new government. Because many people who were the landowners went into exile, most in Miami, and some are coming back, assuming that they will be able to retain or regain their land. And the peasants who have acquired that land, I don't believe, will be in a position to turn that back to those people. So, land reform is really not a thing that the Violeta Barrios de Chamorro would push, and her supporters so much. Is trying to privatize land again. There certainly will be an interest to increase production on the land. That is a factor really of a trade embargo. The fact that agriculture production in the last few years has gone down after a spurt of tremendous new agricultural production in many areas. Prior to that, many peasants, independent peasants, did not have credit. One of the major focuses of the Sandinistas was to really development of the rural areas. That was even at the expense of the urban areas, and something that may have come back on the Sandinistas, certainly.
In that last bit of the history, wasn't another effect that was going on at the time, was you were talking about the date for demobilization getting put off, wasn't it also true that the United States didn't think that the Chamorro was going to win, and so it seemed to me that up towards the, right before the election, Baker and crew were saying things that sounded like, well, we weren't really going to demobilize the Contra after all. Right. Did that have any effect on
that? I think absolutely. The Contras all along have been a creation of the United States, and they depend for their existence upon the United States aid. And there was a concerted effort with funding to keep the Contras intact up through certainly the election time. And I think now, only because of international pressure, and now that Chamorro is president, you have to come through internationally with certain guarantees or promises that you've made. We've gone through this whole process to achieve this. That is the demobilization of the Contras. There's no longer a need for it, supposedly.
Phil, it seems to me on that first part, democracy, in order to have that, one needs to have freedom of speech, and freedom of the press, and freedom of assembly, and freedom to believe as you want to believe. When Daniel Ortega made that move afterward, do you think that there is a possibility of those four freedoms? Well, I assume that they're now, so continuing.
You say mobility, speech?
Speech, press, assembly, and belief. I used to say belief because
assembly,
when you say freedom of religion, and you need to also have freedom not to be religious.
Okay.
But that's still a belief system.
Press.
So
press.
So the press instead
speech.
Of mobility.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Those three. And, you know, at times it varied with under Sandinista, you know, they pulled off the president for a while. And it seemed to me at the end Daniel Ortega had moved to a more democratic position for many people to do all of these things. And but my question is, what chance do you think of that freedom that they have now continuing? And Chamorro not moving to try in some way freeze out Sandinistas, because if democracy is going to prevail, not only do all the parties that joined with her, but the Sandinistas need to have a free voice.
There's an article in a magazine called Envio, which is a publication of the Central America Institute and of the, just recently they joined together, the University of Central America at the Catholic University in Managua, which talks a lot about the style of democracy that the Sandinistas chose. There are sort of two prongs to their democratic movement. One is representative democracy, which is what you're talking about. The other is the participatory democracy, which they began very much so in the early part of their rule with real mass participation of the base, their supporters within the mass organizations. But the analysis that's going on right now is saying that the mistake that the Sandinistas made, and that they're going to have to change if they're going to retake power or if they're going to regain support at all, is to go back to their bases, go back and reestablish that participatory democratic principle instead of through the pressure that was put on them because of the low-intensity conflict and the economic embargo and the terrible state that the economy was in. They formed alliances with the bourgeoisie, and they moved more and more towards representative democracy in their assembly and in the elections, and more away from the participatory democracy that they had begun to place priority on. And I just want to read a couple of paragraphs from this this article, which talks somewhat about that and about some of the mistakes that analysts are now saying that the Sandinistas made in their definition of democracy. And let me just read this. Given that U.S. aggression is an inevitable challenge from the outset, A major contribution to future revolutions is to understand the inadequacies of the FSLN's strategy and political response, which gave the revolution's enemies more tools with which to win support than they had otherwise would have had. The problem, in our view, lies in the ways the FSLN dealt with the contradictions of its model of political, social, and economic transformation. It implemented a state-dominated economic transformation project and an alliance with the bourgeoisie that alienated the popular sectors in rural and urban areas. The advance in representative democracy through elections moved faster than the democratization of participation within the popular organizations or in their relations with the state and the vanguard party. Pursuit of the revolution's uncompleted agenda would be seriously endangered by a belief that popular support for the FSLN can be recovered and consolidated without first making every effort to overcome these contradictions. One of the chief accomplishments of the revolution was the recovery of sovereignty. With it, people expressed their just aspirations in unexpected ways, and the electoral results demonstrate the risk of continuing to think that the equation, the FSLN equals people, is an unalterable historical fact. And I think what the Sandinistas need to do now is to go back to that equation and go back to the people and reinstate the people power, if you will, within their organizations, and maybe even take the risk of separating those mass organizations from such complete domination by the party and allowing the people themselves to make the decisions rather than having it be top down. As more and more pressure was put on the Sandinistas, more and more tendency was to make top down decisions.
Is there any other political party or group who would be representative of that kind of thinking who would move if the SLN won't do it? Because that, you know, what usually is the problem is that, it seems to me, you've got people who are looking at power, and it's either state power or else it's economic wealthy to have the power. And both of them seem to forget about the people themselves.
Well, what happened?
And a lot of political parties move in that way.
What happened was that the people became the subjects and sort of the receivers of subsidies, but they lost their ability to really be participators in the struggle. And I think the Sandinistas have got two choices now. They can, in some ways, cooperate with UNO and work within that system, which is going to keep them separated from the people, or they can decide to take some risks in terms of their political clout within the system and really go back to the people and start to reestablish that participatory democracy and step back a little bit from the representative democracy.
Well, all the time another one developed amongst the people.
Yeah, could be. I think that there's no doubt that the greatest organizational structure, political structure within Nicaragua today is the Sandinistas. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And you can see that even up to the week, say, before the elections, and even now, the ability of the Sandinistas to mobilize people. And we have some photos. They just outnumbered massively in terms of their demonstrations with people at the rallies. The other political parties, on the other hand, including the final rally of the UNO opposition, hardly mobilized anyone. That's not true, not anyone, but very relatively much smaller, 10% perhaps of what the Sandinistas did. What happened then? It seems to me that the nature of international observance and this space that actually the Nicaraguan government, that is the Sandinistas, allowed, permitted an entire strata of people that is not necessarily organized but has the option of voting to come out for the first time. And that's what I felt when I would go to some of the UNO rallies. People, particularly the small and the, many of the poor peasants who never became part of the Sandinista structures. The Sandinistas could not, in 10 years, organize all of society. It's impossible, I'm sure, anywhere. And there were many people that were never touched by some of the benefits of that revolutionary process. The effort went into the cooperatives, the unions, that did represent, say, let's say this 40% that did vote for the Sandinistas. Yet there were a lot of disenfranchised people. I don't think we can discount the fact at all that the trade embargo, the alliance of the Chamorro with the United States flow of eventual economic assistance was an enticement for people to vote. And the fact that the United States then supported actually another military, another great sector of the Nicaraguan population with family members within Nicaragua, particularly up along the northern border of Nicaragua when I went there, both for Daniel Ortega's visit and as Chamorro's visit. It was clear that people would come out in feeling that because the United Nations was there, the Organization of American States was there, international observers like ourselves, and we wore identifying T-shirts, people would say, you are the ones that are the guarantors of a free and fair election here, not the Sandinistas. And we thank you for your presence. It allows us to say a word that we couldn't otherwise say, is what they felt. Yeah.
I was just going to, in terms of looking at the election results, I was in Nicaragua in January, and then the elections were a month later, and I was, I think, as surprised as anybody else on the results. But the thing that I was so struck with in January and the previous visits over the couple of years was just how utterly weary the people were from
yes.
the economic, primarily the economic situation and also the war. Those two things combined had just absolutely drained the life out of that country.
That's right.
And that in many ways, especially in retrospect, having talked with many people who are still working in Nicaragua, talking with the people, that the election ended up being a referendum on the possibility of ending the war and turning the economy around. And people, many people who otherwise may have supported the Sandinistas became convinced that to vote for the Sandinistas would continue the economic collapse and continue the war.
Yeah.
And so whether or not they liked to, you know, many I'm sure voted because they were convinced it would do something, but it's, apparently many also seemed to have voted to, this was they saw this as the only way out of a just absolutely desperate situation. I don't know if that matches your feeling from Mavis or Phil from the time you spent.
That's a very good and essential point, Dan. And I'll compliment that without, and you're right, that absolutely right on target there. The other thing is a certain interest in sending a strong word to the Sandinista, even among some Sandinista supporters, that, look, you're not going to get, say, the majority of the votes that you've had before. There are certain elements that we are critical of, and there needs to be reform within the system. I think probably there may have been some people who voted for the opposition as a protest vote that later felt
they wished they hadn't. Because they were surprised too that.
At the same time, now feeling that this next 6 years is gives the Sandinista Party the possibility of a certain purification that needed to go on, because 10 years of power has the capacity of a certain corruption and certain alienation of people in power from the base. And one, two, three.
What's the prognosis for the church in Nicaragua, the popular church and the in charge, the bureaucracy?
Yeah, very good question. Very important question. Certainly, the predominant church, that is, if you equate that with Cardinal Ovando y Bravo, has a very prominent role, and the Vatican representatives. Representative there. They have taken a more moderate stance than they took initially. That is in absolute support for a Contra solution. There's never been a problem of freedom of religion within Nicaragua, absolutely not. There is a split, a very strong split within the Catholic Church within Nicaragua. The base Christian communities, the popular church, if you will, popular in the sense of not being a different church, parallel church. It is part of the one church, but, and that's not often understood. When the Pope came, he tried to drive that wedge there, that this, you're creating an alternative, or you're creating a new church. Huh?
Parachurch.
Parachurch, exactly. The base Christian communities are still active, certainly, many committed priests and lay people, to a different kind of process than that of a top-down hierarchical church. Basically, I think that within the evangelical churches, there'll be an interesting dynamic there. Most of those have come together around an organization known as CEPAD, which Jerry Aker was a part of the formation of with Nicaraguan evangelical leaders. It now brings together 60 churches. They have had a good working relationship with the Nicaraguan government of the Sandinistas. The new government of Chamorro does not trust CEPAD. And one of the things that we were working on just in the weeks after the election was trying to build a bridge to the UNO. And it took some effort to get some avenues, anybody to talk to us within the UNO structure. And time after time they said, well, CEPAD is too aligned with the Sandinistas, which is really not the case totally. They've been critical in some very constructive ways within the Sandinistas. On the other hand, some people within, they have had a good relationship. In fact, we met with Daniel Ortega 2 days after the elections because of Daniel's care for the support that he's had with the church and that working relationship. So there, I think there's going to be some tension for some time, and they will try to find some other Christians, evangelical, perhaps more fundamental, to be their counterpart, the UNO will. In fact, they have named now a liaison to the religious sector who formerly owned all of the supermarkets in Managua. He comes out of a fundamentalist evangelical background. Cardinal Obando Bravo does not like the evangelicals within Nicaragua. And we were, in fact, surprised, again, privileged to get a meeting with Orlando Bravo as our delegation of Protestants around the world, because he has turned down on a number of occasions. So there is that split also. That's not enough on that. There's a lot of dynamic. It is very complicated. Yes.
So as the Sandinistas began to court the bourgeoisie, besides losing some of their contact with the people, what other effects were there that have been visible, documented, and so on?
Well, they focused, as they courted the bourgeoisie, their purpose was to try to revitalize the economy, so it was a way to focus on export economy, which further marginalized and harmed the domestic product people, the subsistence farmers, the cooperatives, who attention then was taken away from them. The subsidies continued, but again, the real impetus for those people to participate in what was going on in the country ended. So it was, the reason was to try to revitalize the economy, to try to make Nicaragua a place where foreign investments would come, and so they had to focus on the bourgeoisie, and that left out a whole huge sector.
One question there. Yes?
Well, I had a comment. First of all, that I'm just once again overwhelmed when I hear all this stuff. I mean, the amount that the U.S. thinks that they can run things. I mean, my closest sort of oppressive situation in Senegal, I mean, as I said, the U.S. doesn't have a lot of power. Our neighboring country to the north, Mauritania, was kicking out tens of thousands of its own citizens. Everybody knew it. Everyone was against it. The U.S. people, you know, all personally could say they were against it, but they just sort of said, well, you know, we can't say anything. It's an independent country. They're not supporting, and we just, you know, that's how an independent country is. And I kind of finally said, well, yeah, you know, it's true. In the world, you know, independent countries can do what they want, and you can't dictate them. And it's just an immense contrast to $9 to $16 million in the elections. I mean, when you think what that can do for in agriculture, in emergency aid, in family planning, whatever, I mean, it's just overwhelming to me. So I just wanted to say that.
Very good.
My question was, again, in response to this election, you said people were just so tired of the situation. Do you think that the U.S. would have accepted the elections, even with all these observers and, you know, the church, the UN, everybody, if the Sandinistas had won? Was that not a...
That's, again, a very good question. I think, yes, they were backed into having to do it, at least formally. There would have been a formal recognition of Ortega as president. Whether or not the Contras would have been disbanded, I doubt it. And there would have been some other ways to keep that alive. Also, I think that there would have been a short-run reduction of hostility, but the maintenance of the economic embargo, perhaps, certainly not considering it among favorable nations with whom to trade, and continuing some kind of apparatus to destabilize.
And the pressures on the international lending organizations wouldn't have lessened, so Nicaragua would have remained strapped, in my opinion.
I also think the United States Embassy was surprised. We had a conversation with the chargé d'affaires of the U.S. Embassy before the elections and then immediately after, and though he said he was not surprised, I think they were caught also with certain surprise.
What do you think we can expect from our government in terms of their response to a Sandinista opposition in Nicaragua? You know, in other words, if the Sandinistas are able to make headway in the next election, should there be one, or whenever that will be?
That's an important point. We're running out short of time, but just briefly, within the assembly, the Sandinistas still have the capacity to block constitutional changes. Now, one of the things that was revealing is that the chargé d'affaires said, well, he didn't think that the FSLN opposition would remain strong in the assembly. In other words, I think one of their tactics will be to try to continue to weaken the FSLN to be able to get some constitutional changes, backing away from the reforms that have been made on behalf of the majority of the people of Nicaragua, backing toward more of the interests of the private sector. I think that'll be something, and immediately we'll see. I'd like to read just a couple of paragraphs from the Latin America Studies Association report on the electoral democracy, their elections. A few of these people are good friends. Martin Diskin from the University of Pennsylvania and others, Thomas Walker. In the light of where we're going and what this may represent, what are the learnings out of this last 10 years and this electoral process? This won't be the last time we'll see important elections like this. We could look at November this year in Guatemala, El Salvador, perhaps next year in March, certainly possibly Haiti, which has asked for UN observation, elections perhaps in October of this year, also in Cambodia, where the United Nations may do observer observation. The 1990 Nicaraguan elections represented a, quote, free and fair, quote, unquote, electoral process within a climate of United States-generated military and economic pressure. The intense scrutiny and analysis that these elections have aroused serve to illuminate both aspects of this process. A review of the dreary, often illegal behavior of the United States in marshaling military, economic, and diplomatic power against a small, weak country suggests that U.S. foreign policy has altered its modalities, but not its fundamental intentions toward Latin America. The great difficulty it had in pursuing this policy of undermining a sovereign nation shows that such behavior is increasingly subject to the criticism of North American citizens as well as other countries. Although tarnished by North American interference, the Nicaraguan electoral process has pointed to an interesting and hopeful result. Given regional efforts to produce agreements above reasonable preconditions for election and given permission for international observation, a democratic process can be encouraged. In the Nicaraguan case, as of March of this year, when this report was written, an incumbent government with a powerful military appears to be moving toward a peaceful transition after losing an election. I think that's more so today. This will help to establish the principle of civilian control over the military, virtually unique in the area. A movement that began as an armed insurgency has demonstrated its capacity to mature into a serious political party that will be active as a democratic legal opposition. But for this costly and complex effort to establish a precedent, it will be necessary to take seriously the healthy elements of the process. Just as the FSLN has respected the results of the election, the United States must not distort the political future of Nicaragua. For the United States to demonstrate the same capacity for political learning, that's interesting that we may have something to learn of, it could lend its weight to negotiating preconditions for free and fair elections, international monitoring of the electoral process, and civilian control of the military in neighboring states of the region, i.e. Guatemala, El Salvador particularly, and Haiti. The Nicaraguan elections of 1990 would then have served the broader role as a contributor to regional peace that their organization and administration clearly warrants. Thank you very much for joining us again. Thank you.